You're in Mobile? Is that
You
right?
know, you did a good job there pronouncing it. If you're down here, it's Mobile.
You're in Mobile,
Right.
and you drove up from Pensacola. Is
I
that?
drove over. It's a
Oh.
lateral ride. It's not a
Oh, that's right.
north-south kind of thing.
Do most people in Pensacola leave town, or they all stay?
They stay here. It's a poor town, so you can't really be adventurous and experimental. And it's not like, you know, like if you live in Utica, New York, you go down to New York City and it's an adventure. Whereas if you go from Pensacola to Mobile, it's not an adventure. It's just a bigger Pensacola.
Where would oh,
Where would you go
if
to have
someone
an
went to the big city,
adventure?
they'd have to go to Atlanta or Birmingham or
They go to New Orleans if they went
uh-huh.
anywhere, or they go to Disneyland. Disneyland's made 8 hours in the other direction. Pensacola is, you know, he's a cultural wasteland. That's why there's so many churches there, because they, you know, that's what we have as a substitute for culture.
The French photographer who just passed through here on his way back. He was saying it's just all gun shops, strip joints, and churches. And I said, well, where do you think those songs come from? There you have it.
Yeah, I never thought about it growing up. It never once occurred to me until the journalists started showing up and asking me questions about my crazy little town. And once they did, I started, you know, it's like you don't notice that you've got a mole on your face until somebody points it out, and then you can't not notice it. Like there they were, you know, saying, gosh, there's four churches on this corner, and three of them have, you know, longer names than you could possibly envision a church having, you know, like the Greater Inner Light Fantastic Celebration of the Pentecostal Uprising with Cherokee arrows stuck in the side. You know, it's like they all got names like that, and you know, they just couldn't believe it. And then I started looking around and realizing the same thing that you just said, which is, well, no wonder I got all that stuff in my songs. And it never occurred to me before that. Sometimes when you grow up in the midst of it, it doesn't seem alien or foreign to you. You need someone to come and show you how foreign your world is. And I was grateful to them for that.
Speaking of guns and churches, you think there's a things is there a connection between violence and ecstasy?
Now, did you get that out of the interview question book?
Yes, I did.
Is
That's one of
there a
the first ones
connection?
they tell you to use. They said
Yeah,
if you want to confuse your subject,
is there a...
throw this one in. All right, you want, I'll go for another one.
Sure. No, I can answer that. It's an interesting question. I think that when you're confronted with profound boredom, you will take either. You will take either sensation,
So you think it's about
violence.
boredom?
Yeah, sure. You know, when you're living in an impoverished town and you don't have much of a chance of anything ever happening, it's like William Faulkner said at the end of The Wild Palms, between grief and nothing, I'll take grief. Now, as I've become more and more of a mystic in my old age, I'm more intrigued by the proposition of nothing. But for a long time, grief seemed okay to me because I was so profoundly bored. In the world that I was in, because it is a cultural, I mean, other than the South, which you can't really see because you are part of the South, there isn't a lot of culture coming down there. You know, it's like the you know, sea troop of the Cats revival come to town, and that's culture.
Well, there's a different kind of culture. Wouldn't you say it's in some ways a deeper culture?
Yeah, but you see, it's a culture to those viewing it from the outside. To the people participating in it, it is just simply living, and that's different. You don't notice the gems as much, I think, when you are caught up in the midst of it. You can't notice how pretty a river is if you're 6 feet
Swimming,
under
yeah,
the water,
exactly.
drifting along. If you're flying in an airplane over it and you look down, you say, "What a magnificent river." Well, I never got a chance to say what a magnificent river until I left home and traveled all over the world, and then from a great distance looked at my home and said, God, what a beautiful place. Let me go back there. And now as I'm back there, I really appreciate it. But I don't know that the people that are here really think about it much.
That takes us right into the album. All right, yeah, these people on the album are pretty isolated as individuals.
And they're all looking for redemption in a way. The album is, you know, there's not any, I didn't sit down with an idea and say, here's my theme and I will expound upon that theme in 12 songs, being 6 minutes long each. I just started writing about characters and collecting characters, and all of them seem to be kind of organized around the same principle, which is trying to extricate themselves from, you know, a terrible darkness which has descended upon them. And in some of the cases, the characters try to extricate themselves and fail, and in other cases, they don't fail. I think that's a fair cross-section of my experiences. I've failed a lot at trying to get past my limitations, and every once in a while I make a little, have a little success. I feel like I've left part of that baggage of the past behind. You ever do that? You write songs to facilitate leaving something behind?
Yeah, sometimes I don't realize it until 6 months, a year later, I look at it and realize, well, I was basically just describing what I was going to do.
Yeah.
I was writing.
Isn't it funny?
Yes. I didn't know it, but I was writing a little game plan for myself here.
Yeah, I think Woody Allen did that in his films. You can see a lot of times Woody Allen making his game plan in fiction before he tried it out in real life.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with that, giving it a sort of a fictional dry run.
Mm-hmm. See how it works. We'll see how it works out. And if you can figure out a good ending for it, then let's see if that'll happen. What do you talk about when you're working with the various people you've collaborated with, Andrew Hale or the more Chiba folks or whatever?
You know, what I generally try to do is walk in and see what they'll let me get away with and what they want to get away with themselves. Like More Chiba, they wanted to produce the whole track and they didn't want me to do anything. And I have enough faith and trust in them where I could sit back and just keep my mouth shut, which I did. And you know, for me to keep my mouth shut is it takes a miracle for me to keep my mouth shut, you know, like two miracles and, you know, another half a miracle besides that. But, you know, there was such a sympathy between them and me and such a trust that I didn't have any problems with anything that they did. I just marveled at their talents. You know, like the guitar player Ross Godfrey is a very lyrical entity, and the programmer brother Paul, he has a very keen sort of intellectual idea of what needs to be done. Like he has a structural idea. And then Pete Norris, the third kind of spoke in the wheel of More Chiba, he has a great engineering mind. So between the three of them, and there were times when their roles got blurred and one did the other one's role, but between the three of them, all the realms that I'm concerned about, you know, being technical, structural, and lyrical, all of those were covered. So I just basically sat on the couch after I did my little part and let them produce. With Andrew Hale, it was completely different. He was very, very keen on making sure that I made everything just the way I wanted it. So I've had to take the role more of producer. And then at a certain point when things were already shaped and formed, he would jump in with his ideas, which were just lovely ideas. He brought in all the interesting people and, you know, mostly when I work with someone, I want to talk to them at length before I work with them to make sure that we get along. Because if we're not going to get along, there's no way we can make a good song together, I think. You know, I haven't done that many albums. But I don't know if your experience, you know, you have a similar mindset. But
I think that there seems to have more to do with whether you can have a conversation.
Right. Well, you know, a song is just a sort of a recorded conversation. You know, it's not just a conversation of words, but a conversation of notes and a conversation of intervals and tones and feelings and all those things. If you'd like to buy my book, it's on sale at Barnes & Noble. It's called A Song is Just a Conversation by Jim White. 1995 for a recorded copy of my personality disorder. That's the line Johnny Dowd gave me. I said, how's it going, Johnny? He goes, Pretty good. 1995, a recorded copy of my own personality disorder.
Before that, you start working with those people,
mm-hmm.
I've heard some of the demos, the demo versions of songs. They sound pretty deliberately kind of lo-fi.
It's not deliberate.
Oh, no?
It's just... No, it's not like, let me be lo-fi. It's just, you know, I get in this little trance when I'm doing things, and whatever is near me, I grab. And usually what's near me is cheap equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't think, I'm doing this demo, let me go rent the right microphone. You know, if there's mm-hmm. a Radio Shack microphone next to me and I'm trying to sing that part, then that Radio Shack microphone's going to get used. Because it happens to be an arm's length. So there's a kind of a haphazardness. It's not deliberate lo-fi. It's haphazard lo-fi.
Is that changing now that you're...
Yeah, I got a Pro Tools now. So it is changing, and it's getting harder and harder to do a demo. Because
uh-huh.
it used to be I only had four tracks to work with, you know? And I maybe, you know, I was working on a Fostex 4-track for, you know, 30 years. And all of a sudden, you know, I've got a Pro Tools, little Pro Tools 001, Digi 001, and I've got 24 tracks now. So I can't do anything simply anymore. And that's a blessing and a curse.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happens quickly anymore. I used to bang out a demo in a day and a half, and now, you know, it gets real complicated. It's like a month to do a demo for a song.
Phew.
That's just to let you know what the next album's going to be
yes.
like.
Yes. It's going to be a long wait.
Thankfully, for the next album, I already have, you know, I wrote 70 songs for this album, 70 or more songs. And I've got like a whole album of driving, hard, intense songs, which I didn't do because they didn't feel right for this album. But so the next album, you don't have to worry too much about demos because they are pretty much already exist. There's a lot of good songs sitting out there.
I know I still think on those terms, in terms of an album as a kind of collection of songs that hang together that have something to do with one another. You think
yeah.
that's going to go away as people, say, just download only their favorite song? People start making, by swapping tracks and trading things with their friends, they're going to start making their own CDs that have just their favorite songs on it. So they'll be making their own compilations.
The point is, what difference does it make? You still got to be satisfied with what you're putting out. When I put out an album, I want to think that there is a sort of a wholeness to it. I know that it's fine for things to fragment, because from fragments you can make a mosaic of new things. You know, maybe the wave of the future is going to be albums. Like, you know, people have been making them for years, little compilation albums. Like, my sister always used to make me albums with Emmylou Harris on one song and, you know, another artist on the next song, and there was some unifying thread. Maybe people will become more conscious of the idea of fragments and how they inform on other pieces. Like, you know, like a person who makes a mosaic, who finds a little piece of red plate and a little piece of red pottery and says, these two are alike, let me put them next to each other. Maybe people will do that with music, but, you know, my job is just to present a, you know, what I feel like is a kind of a cohesive whole. Like the first album that I made, I wanted to make sure when I put it out that it had sort of the parameters of what my career as a recording artist would be. So the first album, one song was very far afield from the next song. I thought that was good, because not only did it satisfy the itch that I had to put that song in the album, but it also said, please don't put me in alt country, folk, heavy metal, Christian rock. Please don't put me in any of those categories, because I'm not really interested in categories.
Let me ask about some of these other people, because I've heard the songs, but I don't know really who they are. Who is Q Burns? What does that mean?
The word Q Burns means DJs get it on their records when they keep coming back to a particular cue. So he's a kind of a trippy hip hop DJ, guy from Orlando, Florida, who had a nice album out called Feng Shui, which you know what Feng Shui is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the some sort of spiritual art of furniture arranging or something like that. But anyway, he had a nice album out that was real interesting and textured and layered. And my manager, you know, everybody, when you're making an album, everybody wants to help. And my manager was very fond of his stuff and said, listen to this. And I listened to it and I thought, this may be a little too, you know, hip for me. I don't like being fashionable, and this felt pretty fashionable. And so, according to my philosophy, I said, well, I want to meet him and talk to him. And when I met Q Burns, he was a kind of bookish-looking guy who was the son of a scientist and a teacher. And I've always gotten along real well with the children of scientists and teachers. So we collaborated on one of my favorite songs on the album, Ghost Town in My Brain. It's such a strange blend of sort of mythic Western and Eastern rhythms and all kinds of things. He has a little tiny studio about the size of a bathroom, you know.
Uh-huh.
That's the beautiful thing at this point in recording is you don't have to have a big fancy studio to do a good job. There's a guy out there who recorded a whole entire album in a Rambler American.
Really?
Have you ever heard that? Yeah. I don't know. I can't remember what it's called. It may be called Rambler. But he recorded the whole album, drums, bass, everything, inside a Rambler American, which is, of course, a car from the 60s. It's about the size of maybe a Buick, say a Buick LeSabre from the 60s.
It's not a compact, but...
Mm-mm. It's sort of a mid-sized car. He recorded the whole album in there. And you know what? I heard it. It's a pretty, you know, it's engineered like you wouldn't say, gee, that was recorded in a Rambler. And you got to give the guy credit. I mean, recording an album in a beautiful car is a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just philosophically, you know, sonically it may not work, but philosophically it's a beautiful idea because that's, you know, to me, the big American car is, you know, it's like the epicenter of the American dream. You know, you hear a lot about cars in my songs. I was conceived on a cross-country trip and have had, you know, Wanderlust since I was... Was that Wanderlust? That's
yes.
More, actually, more what I do.
What's that about? The American car thing about? Is that about not having roots? Or?
Well, I think really, really, really the whole American ideal of the proper family life being, you know, you always take your promotion in your job, even if it takes you away from your roots. You know, America's a very uprooted place. Subsequently, you know, when you get to that new town, you know, it's like you don't have any family there and you have no purpose for being. It's like a plant with no roots. If the wind blows, it's going to blow it away. I think America is a country without a lot of roots. That's why I like the South so much, is because I think the roots are a little deeper there. There's a little more culture and foundation, and people blow away less in the South than other places. But it still has some of the fine qualities of America in that the people aren't entrenched, and there isn't a cultural inertia. Like when you go to Europe, there's a sort of an inertia which keeps things very stable, which you really notice when you come back to America. It's not there. That stability is just not there in most, you know, medium-sized cities and up. You know, Pensacola, you know, being at the bottom of the medium-sized city spectrum.
Let me ask about this guy from Japan, Soichiro.
Yes, Soggy Cheerios, yeah. We call him Soggy Cheerios. That's his handle. I think he's a big CB guy in Japan.
I didn't know that.
So if you happen to be 18-wheeling your way through Yokohama and you hear Mr. Mystery Mountain Man on, you know, Channel 19, you'll know that it's Soggy Cheerios Suzuki.
How did he fit into this? Did he get in touch with you? Did you guys get in touch with him?
It's real strange. Once again, my manager she has a very eclectic taste in music, and she's interested in kind of what's out there on the horizon. And she had explained to me that there was this band called the Yellow Magic Orchestra in Japan that she really liked, and was I interested in working with them. And she sent me some of the stuff, and it was quite exotic and
beautiful. This is all electronic, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, I hate being stuck in a genre. You know, I really despise being stuck in any particular genre. And so it seemed to make a lot of sense to do something completely offbeat. And so she contacted some people, and it turns out that the producer that was most responsible for their sound was this guy, Sohichiro Suzuki is his real name. And strangely enough, Sylvia contacted him, and he said, of course, he would love to work and was so happy about it. And we sent him the tracks, and they came back as dreams. They weren't songs anymore. They were strange little cinematic dreams. But I was checking through my website mail from, you know, a year and a half or 2 years earlier, and there was his name. He had sent me an email saying he would love to work on my album, my next album, because he had heard the first one. And it was just so puzzling because Sylvia had come up with him like, sort of out of the ether, and he was trying to contact us in a similar fashion. And you know, a lot of trying to get something done, a lot of the hard part is just trying to actually get to people. So there was a kind of peculiar synchronicity at work there. We ended up letting him do two tracks because we liked what he was doing so much. He just understands that, you know, a song should not be just a, you know, a bunch of little rhythmic parts, that a song can, well, I won't say just rhythmic instrumental parts. You know, he understands that anything can be an instrument, you know, like your shoelace can be an instrument, or your, you know, your hair can be an instrument, or the fender of your car can be an instrument. And I really admire him for that, because a lot of times, you know, you'll be in a studio and you'll say, you know, let's do this. And they'll say, well, we'll have to rent, you know, the Roland 44412PX3. And the only way that we can get that is if we have the MIDI interface box board. And then you say, well, okay, well, I'm going to go outside and hit a telephone pole, and it's going to sound exactly the same. And I think that's what he does. I think that he just goes out and gathers location sounds and samples them to great effect. And he doesn't have to have, you know, the $50,000 Roland PX-X4210, you know, Hobgoblin monster thing. He's a very humble, sweet person. He sends me these very cryptic emails that are full of poetry and humility, which is uncommon to find those two together. The best thing about all this, being a musician and coming into the world as a musician, is I get to meet all of these interesting people, yourself included, who have sweet little romances with their little realms. His little realm is this funny kind of sonic cubbyhole that he knows well and loves and has great affection for. And I think you can hear his affection in the way he produces the songs, because those songs, all we did was send him very, very, very simple tracks, like me playing guitar and singing and maybe a keyboard. And he took it from there and did all kinds of beautiful, you know, soundscaping on them. Sonic landscaping. Something like sonic landscaping.
Yeah, do you think it becomes more like a score? Like he's scoring, like you would score a movie.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't see the boundaries of the, you know, the music industry, and I think that's great. You know, when I was working on the first album, if I felt like creating a, you know, sort of like a myth for the song to exist in, I did it. Like in the first album, we made a song called Sleepy Town. I went and got sound effects and put trains in the background and dogs barking and wind, because where we were recording some of that song, Sleepy Town, actually, it was Angel Land, but same thing with the both of them. Where we were recording, it was out in the desert, and there were trains going by and dogs barking, and it was such a beautiful atmosphere that I wanted to put that atmosphere on the album. I didn't go out there with 50 microphones and sit out in the middle of the desert. I just took what was available. You know, I used to work as a sound designer in film. I just took all the available sound effects that I could get, and I tried to create that myth in the songs. And, you know, he Soichiro is a big myth maker, and it's much more fun to create a myth than it is to create a song, provided that you have someone creating a couple songs on the album for you that get top 48 airplay. You know, like that. The Morcheeba guys, when they first approached me and said, we want to help you, they said, you know, we know that you couldn't find, you know, a radio airplay, you know, with a, you know, with a, you know, compass and a divining rod, that you would never be able to make a song that would do that, and we'd like to help you do that. They were very gracious in saying that they were sort of more perceptive of what constituted a commercially viable song, and then took my esoteric little weird songs and put them in a context where they could be heard by a lot of people. And it's, you know, I grew up listening to AM radio in the South, and I love a good commercial song. I don't find any taint on the word commercial. And I think that it's a matter of hubris among a lot of quote-unquote artists who don't want to sound commercial. A lot of them not wanting to sound commercial is just the fact that they're too proud to admit that they have sort of like a connection to the world. And they want to think that there are these singular entities floating out in outer space, these kind of bright, shining, special stars. Well, I'm part of the world, and I don't mind admitting it, and I don't mind reveling in it at times. So if I make a song that sounds like a single with the help of someone like Morcheeba, to me, that's great. I mean, I grew up listening to the Temptations singing Papa Was a Rolling Stone, and the Beatles singing Strawberry Fields Forever, and, you know, Red Rubber Ball, and, you know, John Fogerty singing Green River, and I listen to you singing songs. Mm-hmm. It was that song, Same As It Ever Was, Letting the Days, is it, what's it called? Letting the Days Go By? Once in a Lifetime.
Well, there's nothing wrong with something that occasionally appeals to a lot of people.
Sure. I mean, that's my goal in life, is to work my way back towards humanity. I spent a long, long time slinging myself out to the end of the universe, and when I got there, it was cold and lonely, like, just like you'd expect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you learn something from being cold and lonely. If you're honest with yourself, you realize that, you know, cold and lonely is fine for a while, but you don't want it as, you know, sort of an eternal sentence. So I'm trying to work my way back to humanity, and I'm doing that, you know, with music and words and, you know, the stories that I write. And I want to be part of humanity. I don't want to, you know, turn my nose up at it.
Although I find that there's certain things that I have to do that I realize are not going to appeal to a lot of people. Not everybody's going to identify with it, and certainly the radio isn't. Although, who knows, maybe people will come to appreciate it later on. That's sometimes the case.
Well, you have to make progress as a. I don't like to say the word artist. To me, that's practically a dirty word. You have to make progress as a human being. And I keep thinking, I think a lot about Woody Allen, you know, and I really have a lot of admiration for him. I know he's scorned in the world for his dalliances and what have you, but he you could see that he wanted to make progress as a human being. He didn't just keep making those great, hilarious comedies. He started working on drama, and when he first started working on dramas, he didn't do a very good job of it. But at a certain point, Crimes and Misdemeanors came along, and I really feel like he transcended himself and grew as a human being. And I think that, you know, once you master one particular milieu, that it becomes cowardly to stay there too long. Subsequently, you have to take chances and do things that the people who are in love with that aspect of your personality, you're going to have to do things which is going to confound them a little bit.
It's something that you need to do to kind of heal yourself in some way, to get something out of your system, and you have to do it for your own personal needs, and some of those needs will connect with other people, would identify with,
right?
And but some of them, they're just going to go, well, I may identify with some of the problems he's trying to deal with here, but some of his personal problems are his own demons, and they're his own business, and I don't want to know anything about it.
Right. I think that when you can dialogue about, you know, sort of internal conflict in such a way that it has a universal appeal, like I think good art resonates among everybody, you know, like if you can somehow dialogue about a personal issue and have it somehow connect to universal issues, then I think you're doing as good a job as an artist can do. But there's periods when you're going to have to talk to yourself, basically, and sort things out. And if it benefits one or two people, that's fine. And if it benefits 1 or 2 million people, that's fine. When I first became a... When you first started talking to me about being a recording artist, I really didn't want to do it because it meant being this public person. And I remember I sought the advice of a friend of mine, whose opinion I value, and I said, you know, what do you think about this, me going out there and having to sing these songs in front of people and being this public person? And he said, well, I think it's going to help people. And it had never, ever occurred to me that this internal struggle that I had my whole life and this dialogue that I'd help would be of any use to anybody but myself. And the idea of me writing a song that could somehow help another person solve their problem was sort of bewildering to me. And as I took these songs out into the world and started presenting them to people, at shows, people would come up to me and, God, I remember a show in, I believe it was in Seattle. This lesbian woman came up and started talking to me, and I don't know too much about lesbians. I haven't known too many in my life, and so you have your stereotypes. You know, she had on the keychain, and she looked kind of like a man. And she came up and started talking to me, and she said, "I just wanted to share a story with you. Do you have a second?" And so I said, "Sure." And she said, "My partner and I adopted a child. We had this child for about a year, and it was discovered that the child had brain cancer. She was 2 years old, and she had brain cancer. And they said that she was going to die. And every night we would go to the hospital, and we would listen to your album on the way to the hospital. And there was so much darkness in it, but there was such a hope of redemption that we felt like every time we listened to your album that she was going to be healed." It was this kind of peculiar statement of faith. And she said at the end of 6 months of chemotherapy and the child being near death, it made a miraculous recovery. And she said, "I don't know how it happened, but we thank you for giving us this album, which we feel like contributed to this child's healing." And, you know, when you're sitting writing a song in a room, you never think that this is going to be solace to some person who is lost and wandering through a terrible wilderness. One thing I learned in my songwriting somewhere along the 25 years that I was writing in my little rooms, wherever I happened to be, in the South, in New York, in Europe, and all the places, was that a lot of times if you want something to be conspicuous, you don't lay it against something else like it. So if you take a sad song and put it with happy music, suddenly the sorrow of the song becomes more profound. If I feel like a song is too dark, I'll try to brighten it up with something, maybe within the context of the song, like a pretty bright, happy guitar part or something in the midst of a sorrowful song, something like that.
Or like "God Was Drunk When He Made Me" sounds like a self-reflective. There's a little seriousness there, but of course it sounds like...
Oh, there's anger. That's an angry song.
But it's,
I'm very angry in that song.
And it sounds, of course, like a barroom sing-along.
Well, I can't remember. Maybe it was like Anatole France or someone like that said, dictators don't fear revolutionaries. They fear a witty man with a clever description of his failings. That's a bad one, bad paraphrase. I can't remember the exact phrase, but basically, you know, the real way to subvert something is to embrace the form and then subtly twist it to your purposes. So I'm taking what is like a hybrid of a barroom sing-along and a gospel song, and I am indicting what I feel like is a lot of hypocrisy in the church, and in, you know, the mindset of the so-called Christian community today. I'm taking their template and putting, you know, a little heretical element inside of it. I always felt like if I was ever going to be a revolutionary, that I would do it very secretly, you know, that I would join the other side opposite the side that I was working on, and secretly infiltrate. That would be the best way to create revolution.